Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. All right, y'all. Welcome back to Behind the Knife. We got a special episode today because we're joined with some of our directors of Behind the Knife. We have the Dr. Scott Steele, Jason Bingham, Kevin Canary, myself, Patrick Georgioff. Unfortunately, John McClellan is away defending our country, so he can't be with us at this very moment. But we're excited to be together, and we've got a lot to talk about. Dive in to a common but complicated and sometimes frustrating topic in diverticulitis. This touches so many different specialties, surgical, medical, everything, EM, across the board. And we're also blessed to have one of the world experts. Scott, you happen to know a few things about diverticulitis. You've written a few things. You've talked about it a few times. And, you know, so we're excited to jump in. But before we do so, I think we want to share a few things about what we've been up to at Behind the Knife. We recently released something called Dominate Surgery. We're really proud of this material. It's a course that's made specifically for medical students and a separate course made specifically for advanced practice providers, which is pretty great because there's not a lot out there specifically for APPs. And the content is pretty fantastic, we must say so ourselves. It's a true multimedia experience. And so there's high yield text, it's short text, there's original illustrations, there's tables, there's audio that's particularly useful in terms of preparing for clinical scenarios. And the video is pretty sharp as well. And the whole idea is to teach the art and the science of surgery so that when you get on rotation, you can dominate that rotation. We've just onboarded 18 specialty teams. They're going to start in July. That's really exciting. And we couldn't be more happy with the quality of the educators that applied and the people that are putting the time and energy into what we're doing. This is something we envisioned a long time ago, is that we could have a platform and master educators would come forward and commit some time and their energy and enthusiasm for education. And that's played out. So we are just tickled by that. We've also got a 5 really, really top-notch pediatric surgery teams that are putting together a 30-part series that's going to dive really deep into pediatric surgery topics, really high-level stuff. And so we're getting ready to release that in the near future. And we're getting ready to interview our next round of surgical education fellows. This has been an awesome program, and they've been so amazingly productive as well. And last but not least, we're diving into a general surgery curriculum. This is something that's a very modern format. We think it's going to outperform other things out there, and it's going to be something that general surgeons across the country are going to want to use during training. So as always, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions, comments, et cetera, ideas, please email us at hello@behindtheknife.org or reach out to us on Twitter or Instagram. All right. With that, Scott, you ready to talk about the colon?
Fellas, good to have the game all back together. Nice to see everybody.
Good to see you, buddy.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit today about diverticulitis and specifically kind of some of the finer points. And what I've got in store for us today is we're going to walk through a scenario first, and then we'll kind of double back a little bit and hit on a little bit of the finer points. Now, for each of you, you know, it's lots of nuances here. I completely understand that, but let's delve right in and kind of hit it. So, Kevin, let's start with you.
You pick on the vascular surgeon first.
Absolutely. That's the way that I could do it. It's just like when Kevin was an intern, I had to go back a little bit to him, see if he's sharper than attack. So, Kevin, you're asked to see an emergency department consult. Now, this is a 48-year-old female who is otherwise healthy. She originally presented with a little bit of generalized belly pain, especially kind of in the suprapubic region. She hasn't taken much in. She's had some intermittent low-grade fevers over the past week. When you go down to see her, they give in a little IV fluid, and her heart rate's kind of 90s, 100s. Her blood pressure is 13 over 52, temperature's 100.7. When you walk in the door, you're looking at her and you're like, she doesn't look great. She's not septic, you know, or anything like that, but she doesn't look super good. Now, the ED, as we all know, has already got a CAT scan. And it showed, for all practical purposes, a little bit of a redundant sigmoid colon, a little bit of mesenteric fat straining, a little bit of some small bits of mesenteric air next to the colon. And it's got a small pocket of pus down there, about 3-centimeter abscess that's associated with thickening of the dome of the bladder there. Labs are pending. So how do you wish to proceed?
Having some flashbacks here to Madigan Morning Report, but in this situation, I would, you know, I would want to know if she's had anything like this before. Does she have any history of peeing air or feculent material? And then I do a focused physical exam, really kind of focusing on her abdomen, and then follow up her labs and make sure that she got some antibiotics along with that IV fluid.
Okay. We'll kind of dig in there in a little bit. So I, Jason, to you. So she does not have any prior attacks. This is the first time. And we'll get into a little bit why Kevin asked about, she doesn't say, I don't pee any air. There's no feculent material. And then when you do a physical examination, she's got a little bit of, again, some little bit of guarding, a little bit of tenderness kind of in the suprapubic region and on the left-hand side. And in the lab they're cooking, we'll go from there. Why did Kevin, you know, she saw some thickening there. What do you think of, Jay, when he asks about the peeing of the air or the feculent material?
Yeah, what I think he was getting at is, especially asking what her history was, if she's had prior bowels before, you know, he'd be concerned that she has like a colovesical fistula that could, from recurrent bouts of diverticulitis. You know, when I approach a patient like this, I think you're telling me, you're giving me a stable patient, but my first question is always, is this patient stable or are they unstable? And you told me they appear unwell, but I'm assuming their hemodynamics are normal. They're not grossly peritonitic. And, you know, that's the first thing, really, is resuscitate, IV fluids, stable, unstable. And then I kind of dive into, technically, you know, what's this patient's deal? In other words, what's her past medical history, surgical history, colonoscopy history, all those things.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. What antibiotics would you start her on?
For her, I would start her on Zosyn.
Fantastic. And like we said before, just to be clear amongst the group, there are no sign of any peritonitis at all. So Patrick, the lab's going to come back in, they come back, hemoglobin's 13.5. The white blood cell count is 17,000, a little bit of a left shift. She's got a baseline creatinine of 1, and her creatinine is 1.4. Everything else looks kind of normal. What's going through your mind in terms of next steps with her?
Yeah, so she gets to hang out with us for a little bit. So we'll get admitted to the service. Keep her MPO for now, start some IV fluid, resuscitate. We talked about getting on Zosyn, and we can do, again, keep a close eye on her, make sure those exams don't worsen over time.
Okay, so what are your options available? So you're right. So perfect. We're going to give her antibiotics. Zosyn sounds fine. I think you said we're going to just hold tight on letting her eat a steak dinner or anything like that. So throw me kind of just maybe not necessarily focus on this patient, but what are all the different types of options that might be out there?
Yeah, so it all depends on how severe their flare is. And so if it's a mild thing, you may be able to send the patient home from the ED. If it's moderate type issues like this, you want to get admitted, get on some antibiotics. You mentioned an abscess. I think you said it's 3 centimeters. That's kind of right at the margin of what you may or may not be able to drain. So we want to think about perc drains when appropriate. And surgical approaches for much sicker patients, and as we're moving to the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of different ways to do surgery. And we're going to talk about those today. Lap lavage, Hartmann's procedures, resection anastomosis, et cetera, that all come into play depending on how that patient looks.
Fantastic. And Jason, let's just knock lap lavage kind of right away, because I got a little bit of a bone to pick with it. But tell me a little bit about lap lavage, and then we'll kind of go from there.
I mean, actually, I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts, because I'll tell you, I don't do lap lavage. I never did a lap lavage for diverticulitis during training. I've never done one as an attending. But there are those patients, right? Like sometimes there's those easy ones, like they have a big abscess that's easily drainable, chip shot for IR. You know, we're going to drain this percutaneously, we're going to give them antibiotics, and we're going to kick this can down the road. Then you have, you know, the ones that are just, you know, uncomplicated, or a small pericolonic abscess that responds to antibiotics. But what about those ones where it's kind of intermediate, or somebody where you see a fair bit of free fluid is what always concerns me, is if I see like free fluid that's not contained, they're otherwise clinically stable. Yeah, they may respond to antibiotics, but I'm going to kick it right back to you, Scott, as the expert. What do you do with those patients, and what do you think the role of lap lavage is?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a second, but first I should have level set for the audience that may never have heard this. Patrick, how do you do lap lavage? What is it?
Yeah, and pretty much what it's described as, the laparoscopic instruments go into the belly and you wash them out, multiple liters of saline, rinse and repeat, and leave some drains. And that's about it. You're not doing any resections. If you can get to a collection, you know, and unroof things, drain it, you may want to do that, but there's no colonic resection happening.
Yeah, fantastic. And I know kind of during the hot wash after this, we will go through and show a little bit of the data. But I would just say in general, Jay, you bring up a great point. The problem with lap lavage is, who is it ideal for? You have your patients who do very well without surgery. You have your patients that have percutaneous drainage available, and then you have your patients who need to go to the operating room. So what is the ideal indication and patient for that particular patient? I tell, you know, for a lap lavage, I tell people all the time. So you get in there, you have a abscess that's kind of walled off and stuck up against the abdominal wall. Your bowel has kind of said, hey, listen, I don't want to have free succus all over the place. And so do you take that down? And now you're staring at a hole. Mm-hmm. Right? Well, the hole was up against there. So, you know, a lot of this is not discussed. And then you have a situation where you identify the hole and, you know, what do you do with a hole? Do you just leave a drain by it like there was the original description? Or I've seen videos out there that they almost do a gram patch on it. And right. I try to remind myself out there that, you know, probably the first person who saw a gram patch ever happen on a hole in a duodenum, that person thought they were crazy. And here it's something that we do right there. So maybe there's something that we don't know, but certainly the data that surrounds lap lavage, it was all the hot thing several years ago. And I'm going to show you a little bit of data later that would suggest that the recurrence rate associated with it and the subsequent need for an operation because you can't get through is certainly higher than in just if you would resect alone. And so we'll dig into that a little bit better. So
do you ever do it in your practice now?
Yeah. Any indications?
I never do it in my practice and my patients. And I got to say, for most people, I would just say that if you're able to take them to the operating room, you really think you need to go to the operating room. I feel very comfortable that I can do a pretty defined resection on those patients and not necessarily have to run the risk that we're going to be just right back in for either an urgent operation or just kind of getting in that smoldering diverticulitis, which we'll touch on just a little bit later.
Have you ever had to bail and do a proximal diverting loop, like ileostomy, and maybe you do a little washout, but then you do your diverting loop because things are such a disaster in the pelvis that it's simply not safe?
Yeah, the one thing I like about you, Patrick, is you are absolutely a fan of history in surgery. And so what you're talking about right now is the old three-stage procedure for diverticulitis, where back in the day, this was the standard of care. Patients would come in, they would get a diverting ostomy. That would be the first one. In that case, it used to be open, right? Mm-hmm. Where things were kind of just so stuck down. And then you would go back and you would resect and then put back together. And then the third would be you would take down the ostomy. So have I ever felt the need to have to do that? I would say that that's few and far between. But certainly we all know that in many cases, the inflammatory conditions, especially with bad diverticulitis, can oftentimes be worse than just a cancer resection alone. Okay, so back to our patient. Kevin, you end up admitting the patient and initially they're stable. Now, you go to round and 4 days later, they start to spike fevers again. And, you know, her white count, which initially had dropped down a little bit, is now up to 23,000. She's got some increasing tenderness in the lower abdomen. What's going through your mind now and how are you going to proceed?
Yeah, so, you know, things have clinically changed and, you know, first, of course, make sure the patient's clinically stable. But I'd probably, we're a few days into it, I think I'd want some repeat imaging at this point.
Fantastic. And what's that going to be?
So a CT scan.
Fantastic. And again, I know that you talked about before and Jason brought it up, but our first thing is always to make sure that, you know, the patient's clinically stable. And indeed she is. She doesn't have any peritonitis and you get a repeat CT. And their abscess, Patrick, shows that the abscess is now, used to be 3 centimeters, but now it's 6 centimeters. Pretty large abscess. What's your plan?
Yeah. Drain that puppy.
So you know, you talked about drainage and you mentioned it before, but give us a little bit of some background. We'll give a few scenarios, but first, what is the concept of why you drain a particular patient versus just taking them right to the operating room?
Yeah. So you're hoping you want to do a surgery that allows the patient to be connected without, you know, for instance, a Hartman's. You want to do a one stage procedure. And if you can get this patient through this course with antibiotics, with the drain, that's a good thing. Because then you see them back in clinic, they chill out, they get their colonoscopy, and they come in and get an elective surgery in which they have been prepared for surgery appropriately, and you can hopefully avoid an ostomy in that circumstance. And so that's the primary reason. And sometimes, you know, these patients can have some rocky stays, and people say, well, why don't you just do the operation? And if you can avoid, again, an ostomy and a multi-step or multi-phase, you know, surgical approach, then that's preferred.
Yeah, fantastic. And so again, what we're hoping for in this particular case is you take a very hot, if you will, inflammatory condition, be able to drain away the pus, give the antibiotics, cool their belly down, and then fight the fight another day to be able to go in there. So now I'm going to dig in a little bit more, Patrick. So let's just say that I are successfully able to drain the patient. And I'll ask both you and Jason this particular question. How do you follow, or if you will, manage your drains?
Jay, you go first.
Sure. So, well, you want to follow the patient clinically, make sure that their white count resolves, you know, all that stuff, that they're showing some clinical improvement. And some continue antibiotics, you know, about a 2-week course. At some point, I want to get some repeat imaging, whether that's a repeat CT scan or a drain study to, and, you know, some of that's going to be based on what's coming out of the drain. You know, if they're clinically doing great and the drain output, you know, drops off and it's minimal, yeah, plus or minus on repeat imaging, but I would do complete a course of antibiotics and pull the drain if it's low output. If it's higher output, I'm going to get some studies, maybe a repeat scan, make sure that everything's adequately drained. If it's the output is looking questionable, if it's looking like maybe it's developing into a fistula, I may want to get a drain study. I may want to leave that drain for a longer period of time and you know, go back to my principles of fistula management. But all in all, follow the patient clinically, continue the antibiotics, repeat imaging at some interval, and then management of the drain depending on the output and quality of the output.
Fantastic. Patrick?
Yeah, I don't routinely image them. So I'd follow them clinically, like Jay said, see what the character of the output is, see how much is coming out, and then obviously how they're feeling, how their exam is, et cetera. Oftentimes we'll get a CBC on their return visit. And if they're clinically doing well, the drain comes out. And if there's any question, repeat scan. And if the drain is feculent, then that's a different story. I think that leads you down a different pathway.
So this is one of my favorite questions to ask out there. And I would say that, you know, like many things in medicine, there's just not a whole lot of data to support exactly how you deal with a drain. I love when I sit in panels to ask people how to do. And I've had everything from saying, hey, I get a drain study in every single person because if it connects with the colon, then they have a higher rate of an abscess. Haven't seen that particular data out there. And then I would not pull the drain, or I'd keep it in until the time of the operation, to I never image anything. I just follow and see what it looks like and I pull it in. I think that, you know, no matter what, this is something that you kind of have to stick to your plan, understand what's going on, understand the risks, and kind of go back with the patient. But there really is no right or wrong answer in this. I think it's important to understand what are the options, and in general, exactly what you guys said. We're following our drain output. We're going to go ahead and consider if they're getting worse, that potentially we're going to be able to reimage them. And along those same lines, Patrick, what in general How often do drains, do they not work in and of themselves? Do you have any idea about that?
The drainage procedure itself not working?
Yeah, so you stick a drain in there and you think, hey, I'm going to kind of roll through this particular patient, put them on IV antibiotics and make them quote unquote cool down about roughly in some of the larger series. Do you have any idea how often that drains themselves fail, that you got to proceed right away at the time?
No, I don't actually.
Yeah, it's about a third of the time. And that's a number to kind of keep in mind. And there's certainly a lot of different factors that go into that. Where is, you know, do you get a good drain in there? Is it in a kind of a tricky window that you can't be able to, does the drain get clogged in there? You know, how thickened and how bad is that initial attack that we're talking about right there? So I try to let everybody know that just because, you know, they successfully go on to get a drain, everybody seems to think, whoa, I get a drain, so I'm done. I don't know how to worry about this in a while. I can give them antibiotics. And remember, about 2/3 of the time, maybe even on a high point, 75% of the time it could work, but upwards of 25% to 33%, those drains won't work. and the patient will experience problems. You might have to upsize the drain. You know, you might have to maneuver the drain, or the drain fails completely altogether and you got to go a different route for those patients.
Are you doing any lap drain placements? So like the situation that we'll see sometimes is they have a 6-centimeter abscess. IR says there's no window, can't get to it. And these are always the worst possible patients. They're always BMI 60, you know, poorly controlled diabetes, you know, everything. What are you doing in that situation? Are you taking them to resection or are you doing lap drain placement?
Yeah, in general, no, I don't do lap drain placement. If I got to take out a colon, I'm going to take out the colon. You do bring up a good point, though. There are certain factors that are dependent upon how we take care of certain patients. You know, what are your skill sets? What is the skill sets? You know, if you're in a small hospital somewhere that doesn't have IR drainage, you know, and you can't transfer, that you might be more apt to do something else. BMI is certainly a factor, especially when you're thinking about, hey, I'm going to divert this patient, I'm going to be fine. And all of a sudden you got a foot and a half abdominal wall that you got to be able to deal with for, you know, either a primary anastomosis and a proximal ileostomy or even a colostomy. That might be a very, very difficult challenge that might need to steer you in another direction. You know, in general, if you talk about, hey, I'm going to be able to take that patient in the operating room, I'm going to try to resect that particular one. It's a little bit like the laparoscopic lavage that we talked about without, you know, necessarily having to find the hole or anything. You're just trying to get in there safely and kind of break up with those adhesions. But let's face it, when you have a 6-centimeter abscess, everything's stuck to everything. And sometimes that can be, depending on the time these patients come in, it could be hard as a rock. If you get to it early, you might be able to, you know, do a kind of a washer on the drain placement. But many of these patients, they've kind of already walled off. And what's preventing you from getting a drain in is oftentimes the small bowel. That's preventing what the window is. And so with everything kind of stuck, now what are you going to do? Are you going to, you know, lyse that small bowel and maybe get an enterotomy and have to deal with that? And all quickly how the dominoes may tumble. And so it's important to kind of think that through. So back to our patient. So Patrick, you see the patient in clinic, you remove the drain. She says to you, do I have to have an operation?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And that depends. It depends on the patient mostly. And how many flares have they had? How severe are those flares? How big of an impact is it on their life? What's their appetite for surgical risk? What are their other risk factors in terms of having an operation? All those things play in. And so this patient, she was 40 something, healthy. This is her first flare. She did have perforation, had a drain placed. And so the risk of recurrence in a patient with perforation with an abscess is something to the tune of 30 to 40%. And so you can start with that number. And this requires a little bit of time in clinic. You know, you sit down and you say, this, let's play all this out. And the patient, if they're amenable, this would be a reasonable patient to operate on, certainly because they're up to a 40% risk of recurrence and she's a good operative candidate. On the flip side, if this doesn't fall in line with that patient's values after a legitimate risk benefit rationale discussion, you don't have to operate on them either. So it's every patient is unique in it comes to clinic with this.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about these patients that recover after, specifically after an abscess, or maybe I'm in a big bout and you're starting to talk to saying, hey, we want to have an operation. From our standpoint as surgeons, you know, one of the things we want is we want them to be feeling as good as possible. And then from their standpoint, they're typically like, I feel good. So why do I want to have an operation now? Right. So that's a conversation that I go through these patients and say, you know, it's a little bit like as the tread on your tire starts to kind of wear down. You know, we want to get it to the point before it kind of it pops or it's way down and you're kind of skidding off the road. We want you to get into pretty good shape and to make sure that, you know, you feel as good as possible. So it's just a quick tire change, if you will. And we don't have to be able to go through and have this be a major ordeal. Patrick.
Scott, if you were in clinic with this patient and, you know, you do your whole thing, you talk about the rationale, risk, benefits, et cetera, of surgery specifically for her. Would you recommend you say, as a surgeon, I think you should have surgery, or do you leave it open and say, I would certainly offer you surgery. And then do you let the patient decide? How do you, you know, certainly the patient always decides, but you get my question.
So this is a conversation that I kind of use some overall points over and over and over again. The first thing I tell the patient is, do you have an indication to go to the operating room? And the answer to that is yes. Do you have to go to the operating room? The answer is no. And I start there so that they understand, first and foremost, that if we're sitting here and we get to the point where you go to the operating room, right? Let's think about it. Think about any case you want to be able to do. You want to have an indication to go to the operating room, right? And certainly patients like, you know, do I have to go to the operating room? Do you have an indication? Yes, you absolutely do. Do you have to? Not necessarily. And with those as our building blocks, what I tend to do is I walk a patient through exactly what both you and Jason just talked about. You have a relatively healthy person, fairly, you know, normal BMI that we can handle. You look at your own skill set. That's something that we don't talk a whole lot about, right? What are our outcomes? What do we feel comfortable with? Do we truly have the minimally invasive skills, robotically, laparoscopically, hand-assisted, whatever it may, that you can limit some of the morbidity associated with that? What is your leak rate? We can talk about a leak rate associated with a sigmoid resection for diverticulitis all along being less than 5%. But what is yours as a surgeon, right? We don't talk about that a lot. And if yours is 15%, then maybe that may sway your opinion. Similarly, we talk a little bit about, you know, has this patient had prior operations? Has this patient on Eliquis? They have a heart attack. All of those other things that you both mentioned that I think go into play. Regarding this specific patient, somebody that has, you know, no prior bouts, they've had an ability to have, you know, a successful drain placement to the point where it's out in clinic, they're otherwise healthy. I think that the data would suggest and to lead me in a situation where if they're truly kind of pinning me down, I'd take them to the operating room and I would be able to take out the sigmoid colon, because I think that the risks associated with that operation are lower than maybe some of the risks that go along with this disease or unplanned need to have, you know, quality of life or intervention. Jay, kind of go to that same point. She asks you, she says, is her risk of perforation and the need for an urgent colostomy if she elects not to undergo an operation? When do they typically perforate?
Well, what you always taught me when I was your resident was your first bout is typically your worst bout. So it's typically that first episode. I don't know if that's, as far as I'm aware, that's what the data shows, unless that's changed in the recent years.
No, absolutely, it is the case. Now, here's the tough thing about diverticulitis, though. So there's data that you would read out there or textbooks that you would read out there that would say that every bout of diverticulitis is a perforation, right? That you have these micro perforations that cause it to be thickened and inflamed. But so when we talk about perforation, it's important to talk about an abscess or talk about a free perforation. But remember, in the old days, what we used to think of is that diverticulitis was a progressive disease, so that if you had one bout, the next time you were going to have another bout, it was sure to be worse and then worse and then worse. And then if you look at it all, you're apt to have a perforation on your first time more than anything else. So Kevin, the patient comes back to you and they said, I'll think about that. I'm not quite so sure. Is there anything else that I should do in the interim while I'm thinking about this? So you have somebody that got it's a younger woman. I'm 52. So, you know, she's younger than me and she had a successful drain place. She's feeling a lot better. The drain's now out in clinic as she's waiting around. Anything else you would do prior to proceeding with surgery?
Yeah, I appreciate you tailoring these questions to me. I think she needs a colonoscopy in the meantime.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you want to clear that colon. You want to make sure there's no other concurrent disease. So let's switch up the scenario just a little bit now. And say that the patient presented with no abscess, thickened colon, no fistula. She responds to antibiotics and back in her office. But Patrick, instead of this being the first bout, now this is her third bout. How do you go about in these patients that have, you know, a little bit about elective resection or observation, especially with the patients that have had multiple bouts through?
Yeah. So this just moves your starting place more towards the surgery end game, right? This is what we talked at the beginning. You got to add these things up. And it's good to know about these episodes, how severe they were. You know, we went to the beginning. I always put in all of my attestations for these notes to say how many flares has the patient had, or how much they think, how many times have they received antibiotics, how many times have they been admitted to a hospital, Have they had a colonoscopy? When was it? What did it show? And do they have a personal or family history of colon cancer? What's their past abdominal surgical history? Every single time. A lot of times you see IBD templates, right, from GI and surgery too. Those things are listed. So I put those in there because I always forget. And then if they come back to clinic, I can remember those things. And so this person's closer to surgery. We want to make sure that those flares were actually diverticulitis flares. We want to see if she's ever fully recovered from them. Is this the quote unquote smoldering diverticulitis? And we want to know all about the patient and their lifestyle and, you know, how active they are. And are they traveling a bunch? And what other comorbidities when it comes to their health, their BMI, et cetera.
I think that's great. Lots to unpack there, and we'll get to it in a little bit. Jay, I'll come to you. I'll give you a pre-read to think about. I'm going to ask you about what smoldering diverticulitis is. But Patrick, you brought up a great point. And that point is about, you know, were these bouts truly diverticulitis or not? If you talk to some patients, we've all talked to them, they're like, I've had, you know, 5,000 bouts. But what they're really experiencing is a lot of times just spasm associated with that colon that's become, as we all know, when you operate on some of these patients, what do you see? You see a fibrotic, thickened colon that nothing passes through. And, you know, in essentially they may experience pain and even spasm and associate and attribute that to the fact that, hey, I'm having another bout of diverticulitis and it's not. So it is important, as you said, to say, what is CT proven? What's not? What's they been admitted for? How many times they've been on antibiotics? Although we've certainly know patients that are like, as soon as they feel that, they don't want to go through it again, so that they
on the antibiotics. Yeah.
Yeah. They keep the antibiotics, or, you know, they have the outstanding prescription that they can kind of fill anytime the need be from their primary care doc because they've been so burned in the past. So Jay, Patrick mentioned something that doesn't get a whole lot of press out there, but it's certainly something that we see. And that's those patients that have kind of a smoldering diverticulitis. Can you delve in a little bit there and talk about what that is?
Yeah, so those are patients that kind of have it's exactly what it sounds like. It's smoldering, you know, so it's this low-grade chronic inflammation that maybe never really gets better. They don't really have breaks between their episodes. You know, maybe they'll go on antibiotics, they'll get a little bit better, but as soon as they come off antibiotics, their symptoms return. So it's those patients that have that low-grade chronic inflammation that just kind of goes on for weeks and weeks.
And in those patients, are you more or maybe less apt to recommend surgery?
Yeah, those patients are somebody who just needs the diseased part of their colon out. So it would be definitely more apt to offer that patient surgery.
Yeah, fantastic. So Patrick, let's take a step up. Let's just go up one level. And this is something we could have started with a little bit. And that's the idea of complicated versus uncomplicated diverticulitis. So how do you kind of classify complicated versus uncomplicated diverticulitis?
Yeah, so complicated diverticulitis, something happened that complicated it. So in this case, there's a handful of different things that can happen. An abscess, like in this patient, stricture or fistula are the three kind of biggest, big ticket items that would make a diverticulitis episode complicated.
So I think the important point here is that many patients, when they hear the terms complicated and uncomplicated, they immediately think, well, I had severe symptoms. It was a really bad bout. And it's important to understand that the severity of the symptoms doesn't necessarily talk about the classification of complicated or not. Yeah. Exactly what you said, that if you got a stricture, abscess, perforation, fistula, understanding that microperforations can be in both, it's really those are the ones that make up a complicated diverticulitis. So the very bad thickened sigmoid colon, it could be a phlegmon there. It could be, you know, really, really nasty, really thickened. That could be an uncomplicated diverticulitis. You just don't have the narrowing that comes in from the repeated bouts of fibrosis. You don't have that fistula to nearby organs, colovesical, colovaginal, even colocutaneous, or a small bowel trying to wear it off. Or that abscess that's in or free perforation. So, Jason, you know, if we talked a little bit about the fact about patients in general, it seems like everybody gets a CAT scan. You know, they come in, they have any sort of belly pain, and they go from there. Can you stratify, if you will, kind of degree or bouts or even complicated versus uncomplicated on CT?
Yeah. So this is, if you're an intern out there, you better memorize this, because if you have to present up at the podium a diverticulitis case, you're definitely getting asked about the Hinchey classification. So, you know, stage one Hinchey is inflammation confined to the colon or the pericolonic area. Stage two is a pelvic or, you know, distal inflammation, abscess, basically a pelvic abscess. stage three is purulent peritonitis, and then stage four is feculent peritonitis. Before we move on, though, I wanted to ask you, you know, we were talking about this complicated, uncomplicated. What do you make of the, you know, I know there is some data that says that we don't even need to give antibiotics at all for uncomplicated diverticulitis. What do you make of that data, and are you incorporating that at all into your practice?
Is that just a European thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting balance. So there's actually a Cochrane review about diverticulitis treated with antibiotics versus not. And there's a large trial that we hope to be able to see here in the US that is going to be done. We'll get some good data on that. I still believe that Dave Flum of the University of Washington is leading that particular trial. Now, I think it's important to understand that in most cases, the no antibiotics is not for complicated, because what we know is that for complicated diverticulitis, most of these patients, not necessarily urgently, right? We've for sure seen patients in clinic that have a colovesical fistula and they're doing just fine. They have, you know, urinary tract symptoms that go from there, or have an abscess. But those patients that definitely have uncomplicated diverticulitis, even if it's pretty severe, can be treated as effectively, some of the data would show, with having antibiotics, no, just IV fluids and bowel rest. And they can kind of get through and go from there. The analogy is, I got a strained muscle, I'm going to put it at rest. I'm not going to do any more bicep curls to be like Patrick's biceps. And the reality is that it can go better alone. Now, the hard part is, it is an absolute knee-jerk reaction, especially in the US, to you come in, you get diverticulitis, you're on antibiotics. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, as you all know, by the time oftentimes you're consulted that you go see them in the emergency department, or if they're admitted, they've already gotten a course of IV antibiotics, and you know, it's kind of starting from there.
That's sure. What I would like if I come in with it, please.
Touche, Kevin. So the reality is that even though that the data is out there, part of this is, there's no question, part of this is just the culture of what we've been all trained by. The other part of it is, I guess is a little bit of, maybe a little bit of worrisome if the patient has a bad outcome, that, you know, medically, legally, are they doing the wrong thing by not giving antibiotics? But there's certainly data to support that you don't necessarily, for uncomplicated diverticulitis, describing, again, not with stricture, not with fistula, or not with a free perforation, that you can treat with IV fluids and bowel rest alone. You know, as we talk about these particular patients, though, in practicality, how often does that occur? That's certainly the minimum. But I think that as we get more data, that the patients are going to, you know, there's certainly some patients that would do just fine with that. Patrick, on his initial answer to this entire scenario, remember what he said was, you know, there are certain patients that don't need to come in, don't need IV antibiotics. They can just get an outpatient course of PO antibiotics and do just fine.
On that note, have you ever treated a truly uncomplicated case without antibiotics? Or do you?
I have not. No, that's a great question. I have not. And oftentimes it's just easier to get antibiotics and they do fine. Now, the question that does come up is, you know, what's the downside of antibiotics? And we talk about superbacteria, we talk about C. diff, we talk about all that. We've published at the Cleveland Clinic about C. diff following a bout of diverticulitis, and it certainly is a real thing. We actually found that you can actually get C. diff after a colonoscopy. But, you know, so these things can happen. But in general, I think antibiotics are pretty tried and true, but there is data there to support them.
I think Kevin's question is good. Like, Patrick, if you get acute uncomplicated diverticulitis, do you want antibiotics?
Yeah. Yeah. The question I'd have, though, too, is what
I would say yes as well.
Yeah. What are you giving, either Jay or Scott? What are you guys giving, and for how long? Let's say for a truly uncomplicated course and they're going to leave the ED, or this patient who does great with the drain and goes home, are you doing ciproflagyl? Are you doing Augmentin? Are you doing 7 days, 10 days, 14 days? I know there's some recommendations out there, but.
Dave, go ahead.
Well, we'll typically do 10 to 14 days of Augmentin.
Yeah, and I typically give cipro and flagyl. I think it's, you know, it's pretty decent coverage. Flagyl certainly doesn't taste the best, gives the patients that awful taste in their mouth and go from there, but it's been tried and true, and I'll do 10 to 14 days. It kind of really depends. And you say, well, which one, 10 or 14? And I would say, you're looking at the patient and seeing how they're doing. There's no question that there are going to be certain patients that will transition over to more of a smoldering diverticulitis that might need to have a little bit longer course, or might need to have that imaging that we talked about before to make sure that they're not developing an abscess. Remember, we talked about in this patient, the patient had a 3-centimeter abscess. They started to get worse. Kevin said, go ahead and give a repeat CAT scan, and now it's a bigger abscess. There's certainly those patients who present with just a thickened sigmoid colon, very same scenario. They do a little bit better on the antibiotics, and then day 3, day 4, increased pain, increased white count, or maybe some fevers. You scan them, and they've actually got an abscess now that you can be able to deal with. So it kind of goes both ways, and in that case, your antibiotics may be around a little bit longer. Okay, let's jump back to a couple of intern level questions. And with that, we'll bring back in our vascular surgeon. So Kevin, a pretty straightforward classic PIM question. What are your boundaries for resection? Doesn't matter if you do it open or robotic or whatever. What are your boundaries for resection for a bout of sigmoid diverticulitis?
Okay, so we want to just take the sigmoid colon from what I remember. So do the boundaries involve the rectum where the tineae coalesce? If you want to give me some hints here.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So that's the best one. So we used to say all the time that recurrent diverticulitis for sigmoid diverticulitis occurs in about 2%. And of those 2%, the vast majority, because you didn't get on the rectum. And so you left some diverticulitis behind or diverticulum behind. In that particular case, it's important to go past the point where the tinea splay or coalesce, as you're talking about right there. And then proximally, Jason, what's your proximal point of resection?
So you want to feel the bowel. So you want it to be that soft, supple, not indurated, you know, healthy bowel. You're not going to try to rid them of all their diverticula. You just want soft, supple, healthy bowel as your proximal resection margin.
Yeah, fantastic. And I know that we talked about it before, but if you have diverticular disease throughout the entire colon, that's not the point where you're going to say, I'm going to do a completion colectomy and take it all out. We want to really focus on where it is. And again, that diverticulitis recurrence is still an issue. They don't all go away. And in many cases, though, it is, like we talked about before, you know, less than 3%. So should be able to go from there. Patrick, you're sitting there and the colon itself won't reach. You've resected that bout. What are some maneuvers that you can do to get a nice tension-free anastomosis between the colon and the rectum?
Yeah, you got to be able to mobilize it. And so you can start with the lateral to medial dissection, going along the white line of Tolton, seeing what that gets you. Typically won't be enough. So you want to follow that around and do a splenic flexure mobilization that requires coming all the way around past the spleen to those more tenuous connections or even the pancreas there and really dropping that transverse colon down. That will typically get you to where you need to be, but not always. You can also work along by releasing the peritoneal covering the mesentery. That'll get you a little bit of release. You can pick away at the corners of the mes and you can take in the IMV vein as well. Will be kind of your last trick to getting things to drop down for a standard colorectal anastomosis.
That's fantastic. So I couldn't have said it better myself right out of the textbook. Those are all the keys in order to be able to make it reach. And then I would say the last thing maybe you could do is mobilize the rectum a little bit in that presacral avascular space, get a couple additional centimeters up there, and it'll go well. So guys, we've been at this for a while. Let's go ahead and put a bow on it. So Jason, complicated, uncomplicated, what do we tell the listeners?
So complicated is anything stricture, obstruction, perforation, fistulas are all complicated disease.
Fantastic. Patrick, rules of thumb about a drain. How often do they fail? What are your thoughts and how do you deal with them? Is there any good data there?
Yeah, they fail about a third of the time. You got to be prepared to deal with that. And we talked about taking a look at output, character of the output, effectiveness or otherwise, although we didn't dive into that too much. And typically we want to get those out in clinic and get that patient over the hump to either not operate or operate and do a nice minimally invasive resection with anastomosis without an ostomy.
And I will say, just in general, since you mentioned it, if somebody does have truly feculent output for the drain, that's going to be somebody that I'm going to try to quiet them down, keep the drain in all the way to the point of the time of the operation. I don't deal with it at all. Just let it drain. I say, listen, you form a fistula. We'll deal with this at the time of the operation. We're not going to remove the drain. We'll keep you on some antibiotics. We'll go from there. Kevin, is there an exact number of repeated bouts of uncomplicated diverticulitis that you would say you have to have an operation, the answer rhymes with no.
Yeah, I know. This is a personal decision with each individual patient.
Fantastic. And then finally, just for the last thing, Patrick, boundaries of resection for left-sided diverticulitis.
Just get down to the rectum and get back about the healthy colon on the left side.
Hey, fellas, open mic to you. What things didn't we cover before we kind of sign off of this one with diverticulitis?
We didn't cover the best thing. The best thing is when do you put a patient together and when you don't? I'm an acute care surgeon, and this is always the question is, how do you make that decision? And so I'd love to hear from Jason and Scott on their thoughts on this.
Go ahead, Jay.
I'm a bariatric surgeon, so I divert them. Let's push it over to Scott.
Yeah, so I would say in general that there's a couple of things that will kind of important to know on that particular topic. The first thing is that you can find plenty of literature out there that would suggest that you can put a patient together in the setting of perforated diverticulitis or fairly significant disease. You didn't give me a true scenario, but I'm guessing that the patient's bad enough that you're urgently taking him to the operating room. So we'll say in this particular case that it is free perforation for there, because that's something that, you know, as an EGS surgeon, acute care surgeon, you're going to probably take him for that. There's also data that would suggest that, again, that you can put them together and they can get a proximal diverting ostomy and leave all that stool that's in between, and they do just fine. I think the important points that I try to teach my trainees about is that all sounds good, but you got to look at a couple of things, right? Because this is not cookbook medicine. The first thing is just what we were talking about before, and that's factors to consider with therapy. And that goes into what's the patient's comorbidities. We all know that, let's just say that one of you developed a complication following an emergent surgery for diverticulitis. By and large, you might get sick, but if you leaked or you did something, you could do fairly well. If the person that you're dealing with has all sorts of comorbidities, you know, their ability to tolerate that subsequent complication, you know, you have to consider and have to go to play. And that might be somebody that you're more apt to be able to, you know, do a diversion on. The other thing that is, you know, probably one of the most important things is technically how did that operation go and what is the current status of the bowel? So you get in there and, you know, in general, as we all know, especially for diverticulitis, the rectum itself, the important reason to go on the rectum is the rectum, no matter how bad that left-sided diverticulitis is, the rectum tends to be soft and supple. But there's certainly patients that have a pelvic abscess or have had stool, depending on how long before they presented, in extremis or anything, that inflammatory cascade has gone down the rectum. And all of us here on this call have probably had one way or another had to extend your distal resection margin mid-rectum because things are just so bad. And now you're halfway down. And remember, if you're in that situation, you know, now you're mid-rectum, you know, especially on a male, it could be a smoker, heavy BMI, you're going to divert that patient. You know, you're going to, in one way or another. But when the bowel is very thickened and you're looking at, you know, your stapled anastomosis and your donuts are, you know, true, just giant donuts that have a hard time, and you have some of that tissue that's squeezing out in between your EA stapler, that's somebody that's you're kind of setting up for not to have a good situation. So my rules of thumb are this: look at the patient in front of you and see, are they healthy or they're not? If they have a lot of comorbidities or they're not doing well at the time of the operation, you know, they're hypotensive, you know, really tachycardic, things like that, that's the time to fight the fight another day. And certainly I'm not advocating that they're necessarily the patients that you have to have a damage control procedure on. There is some data that is out there, full disclosure, about damage control operations in the setting of diverticulitis. And again, all you're doing is pushing it to the right. And you're like, hey, just very similar to trauma. Like, I'm going to see what they're in now. I'm just going to get this thing out. I'm going to leave it open. But it's very interesting, and they show that they wind up with less of a chance to have permanent ostomies. The thing that you're trying to avoid is that we know there is data out there that would suggest that if you give a person a colostomy and compare that with a person who has an ileostomy, the person who has a colostomy is much more apt to have a permanency to that colostomy than if they're going to have an ileostomy. And there's one paper out there that suggests that in patients over 70, there's a greater than 75% chance that they're going to live with that permanent colostomy for the rest of their lives. So that's important to know because you're kind of bound and turning them. We wrote a paper at the Cleveland Clinic that looked at the scenario that I gave before. So you have a person that had left-sided diverticulitis. You put them back together and you did a diverting ileostomy. So the question that comes up is, especially if they have a column of stool that is all throughout there,
right,
are they going to have more of a problem by giving them a diverting ostomy? And what we found was no, that they did. It was that was safe. So what does a diversion do? It's a great question. And it's something that I can't explain the mechanics behind it, but it is certainly something that we found and we're worried about it. So I'll be much more apt if I'm going to divert, assuming that I can get healthy bowel to healthy bowel, but I'm still like, it just didn't go quite right. I'm going to give them a diverting ostomy. I will not give them a colostomy. And that's how I think about it.
That's great. I have two short questions that I still have. One, with smoldering diverticulitis, how long do you wait?
If I can get them through, I mean, the classic thing is to say, I want to kind of get you through 6-8 weeks, do a colonoscopy, and then operate on you right away and go from there. The reality is by definition, the smoldering diverticulitis is something that you can't quite get them through. It's the little engine that can't get up over the hump. You know, they get up there and they continue to have problems. So sometimes you have to bite the bullet and just take them from there. So I don't have a set thing, but I try to see if they're truly just really, truly smoldering and they can be semi-stable. If I can get that colonoscopy, what I do is I'd scope them on a Friday and then just let them chill out and then just go ahead and do a case on a Monday, or, you know, if you got scopes on one day and doing the next one, so they only have to have one bowel prep, I think that'd be great. And I figured the question would come in and say, are you still bowel prepping your colons? And I would say the answer is pretty clear that oral antibiotics plus a mechanical bowel prep is probably the best way to go. To just give a mechanical bowel prep in the absence of oral antibiotics, I wouldn't do that. We're not doing that.
And my last question is, we'll see sometimes that a patient comes in clinically hemodynamically stable, tender but not diffusely peritoneal, but they got a pretty significant amount of free air without free fluid. How are you managing that? And everybody kind of freaks out. They see that scan with all that free air, and they say, we're calling the OR right now. How do you manage those patients?
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. I was on call once when I was living in Washington State, and I got a pager at this particular one that said they wanted to have a consult for free air for perforated diverticulitis, lots of it. And so I was expecting to do the exact same thing that you said, and, you know, take them right to the OR, called the OR, said, be ready to go. And when I walked up to the ward, I opened the door, and there was this woman sitting there eating a Subway sandwich. I will never forget it like it was yesterday. And I said, oops, sorry, wrong room. Nice to see you. And I closed the door and I looked at my pager again and I looked at the door number and I was like, they must have moved the patient. Asked the nurse, do you know where Mrs. Blank is? And they were like, yeah, that's her right now. I'm like, but she's eating a Subway sandwich. I opened the door and I'm like, hey, I'm Dr. Steele. I'm the surgeon. And she's like, get out. and I was like, okay, so we know that we don't operate. We always say we don't operate on a radiograph. We operate on patients, and it's cliche, but the point does come. The thing that worries me when I see a bunch of free air is if I see associated free fluid.
Yeah,
if I'm seeing a bunch of just free air, then oftentimes if the patient is stable, what's happened is that they perforated. They didn't have much in their colon. They probably perforated, let out, you know, if you will, a giant fart in their abdomen.
The old internal fart. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it kind of walled itself off and they look pretty good. And I'll be up to have a lower, that to me is not an emergency. But if they have a bunch of fluid in there, that's worrisome. And that would be something that I'm more apt to take the operating room.
Yeah. Well, I just want to end by saying, well, first off, just for Kevin, next time we're running carotid disease, and he gets to pimp Scott on the next one. So everybody be sure to tune in for that. But I remember one of my very first calls as a staff, first year out of, maybe like first month out of residency, I was on call and my chief resident was Dr. Kevin Kinnery. And we got a perforated diverticulitis that we had to take to the OR. And I think we called you, Scott, for your advice. So here we are 8 years, almost a decade later, still asking you questions about what we should do.
I remember that case. I do.
All right, what comes around goes around, fellas, and it's good to have the crew back together. And with that, we'll turn it back to Patrick to wrap things up.
All right, that's all we got. Thanks for listening. We'll be back for more in the near future. Carotid disease next time. In the meantime, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.